This is Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank Fantasy Flight Games for our hobby and their continued support, Drew Dallas at Card Game DB for our hosting, and the AGOT community as a whole for making this possible. Let us take you beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. In this week's episode, we're going to start off with an apology. We'll go over some FFG news and some regional news, and then we'll introduce a new segment where we go over a year in the history of Game of Thrones. Finally, we'll wrap up with our plans for next week and our usual regional announcements. Welcome, everyone, to episode 17. This is only big news because it happens to be our 20th episode, with three bonus episodes so far. And I'm finally back to the real world. I just landed, hours and hours late. I don't have any trips planned for the next few days, at least, and I get to sleep in my own bed, all of which is very nice. So we were initially planning on being able to catch up to the news and getting back up to date. Unfortunately, all these flight delays and John actually having a life and kids, I'm recording this episode alone. So that's entirely my fault, entirely scheduling issues over the last 3 weeks. However, we do have something for you. We have something that we recorded a while ago that we're very, very pleased to be able to bring you. We have an interview with a former champion telling us a little bit about what the meta was like when he won his national tournament, and a little bit about the process and how the game has changed since then. That said, I do want to touch on a little bit of the news for this week so far. Probably the biggest FFG news, as far as I can tell, I have been a little bit out of touch, is that they added a restricted list for the Star Wars LCG. And again, we generally don't touch on the other LCGs to any great extent, but this is pretty big news because, first of all, they didn't have a restricted list, and second of all, they're adding this in a way that's very, very similar to the Game of Thrones restricted list. It's introduced to break up a combo, since you can have two objective sets in your deck. Now there are two objective sets that are mutually exclusive, just like the Game of Thrones restricted list. And it was specifically done because there was a card you could play that would feed your opponent cards in hand, and another card that was reduced in cost for every card in your opponent's hand, and it made a very reliable, very powerful combo, as far as I can tell. So not only is it really interesting that they're doing this, that they're adding a restricted list, and that they're mimicking the Game of Thrones model, which has been quite successful and quite well received. The other interesting aspect of this is that they did it halfway through a regional season. So this was really the meta stagnating, or everyone's gravitating to these decks, and we need to give it a kick. And I don't know for sure. I think this may be the first time that they've released... I think they actually did something similar when they introduced the errata to carrion birds in Game of Thrones, and they allowed carrion birds to only target printed raven characters because of trait manipulation shenanigans. So I think there is at least one previous example of a sort of emergency FAQ, but I don't specifically recall the timing on that, so feel free to call me out. In addition to that, I want to go over some of the tournaments that have come up, mostly because one of them is very, very relevant to this cast. Well, two, actually. Just this past weekend, John Bruno, who was our guest last week, a name most of you recognize, he won Kublai Khan with a Knights of the Hollow Hill deck. And he built a Knights of the Hollow Hill deck on the cast, out of Targ, not Martell. But ironically, he actually discussed the deck that he was talking about, the Martell Knights of the Hollow Hill and how strong it was, on the show. And I had to cut it for time constraints because we really wanted to focus on Targ. So I feel like an idiot for having done so, and maybe we'll use that segment in the future and just prove how prescient John Bruno really is. In addition to that, there have been a lot of interesting tournaments over the last little while. I was specifically contacted by the people running the Singapore tournament. Urban Lamb wanted me to mention that there was a really interesting turnout to that tournament, including a top four that had a Targ Black Sails, a Naval Burn deck, and a Barra Kings of Summer deck. And in the end, the Kings of Summer took the tournament, so it's nice to see some original decks challenging preconceptions and winning these tournaments. Finally, I think it's a shame that I can't have John on to mention this himself, but after we recorded last week's episode, or the few segments I was able to record, he went on to win his tournament in Montreal. So he took a Stark No Agenda and won the tournament, winning a regional. So despite the fact that we've constantly made fun of him for not having won a store championship, he pulled it together and did very, very well with a Stark No Agenda, which is also a deck that we mentioned is doing quite well on the cast. So I'm glad to see that we're still on the right page and that we can still be considered to be giving good advice. Other tournament, I mean, you can't really mention every tournament. There are so many going up on the databases now. But a big one was Days of Ice and Fire, which was nice to see a Greyjoy, a Song of Ice deck win, which is not something that we've seen a lot of before. And I think the German card pool tournaments just started this last weekend because I saw a Greyjoy Black Sails list that claimed to have won a tournament, I think, in Turingen. But don't quote me on that one, which, of course, you all will. Words immortalized. So we should be resuming back to our regular schedule with our regular number of hosts starting next week. However, we still have something exciting for you, and I hope you'll enjoy a taste of Aegot history.
We're here today to focus on an era of Aegot where the North agendas were king, where around every corner we found Nightwatch and Wildlings, a time before restricted lists, and a time where Pyroscatch was so good it was actually banned. That's right, we're talking about 2010. So joining us today is actually one of the champions of this time. So why don't you tell us a little about yourself, your name, and why you're a champion?
Howdy, I'm Alec Irwin. I was the Joust champion 2010 with kind of an old-school at the time Lanny Neal deck that was popular probably in like 2008. That I brought back.
What meta would you consider yourself a part of? Where do you live and how did you attend Worlds?
I live in Wilmington, Delaware, and I met a couple of guys that played in my area. Two of them lived north of here and one lived south, so they met at a store that was actually about 15 minutes away from my house. So that's how I got involved, and I probably started showing up to their game sessions about 2 months before LCG hit. So that was really perfect timing to actually get into a new game without having to chase down old cards. So I got a good start right off the bat.
Okay, so it was a competitive meta, I guess, then? Higher quality players.
Yeah, we would travel pretty regularly to New York to play against those guys and down to D.C. to play against those guys, like what was Eric Butler's meta and Dan.
And still is.
And I guess New York was Staglord.
One of the reasons why I wanted to start with 2010, and I find 2010 so fascinating for the history of the game, is because, and I don't know if you know this, the Chinese meta, which has been burgeoning, finally got their card pool to the same level as ours, and the last cycle that they got was the Defenders of the North cycle, and that was the last one to be updated. So every time we'd see tournament results from the Chinese meta, the deck lists were completely different. The meta was completely different because they didn't have access to some of these key cards like the Return of the Other Melisandre or Hatchling's Feast that are really meta-defining. So having experienced it firsthand, what do you remember of those cards and which cards jumped out from those cycles?
The big one that I remember at the time was the Martell Army that revealed cards coming in and going out.
That's put them in your hand. The Viper's Bannerman.
Yes. That was pretty much like the end-all be-all of Martell decks at that point. I feel like city cards were sort of still getting thrown in a little bit, but because you had to base like your whole deck around them and it wasn't super viable, they weren't as popular as they could have been, I guess. And that was also before you had to pick Night's Watch or Wildlings, right? So there's a lot of mixing and matching of those.
So your actual deck that you won with ran the full city complement, right, for the city plots?
Yeah, well, I think I had five of seven.
One of the odd things that, having come to the game later, I never experienced the Legacy format. I think that 2010 was the last year that the Legacy format was formally endorsed by FFG. So did you ever play the Legacy format? Or
a few times when my meta mates wanted to take a step back and play with like the old good cards that they had. So I would borrow decks from them occasionally, but I never played in a formal setting.
And was that played at the competitive level? Because I see the tournament rules for that era had support for the Legacy Highlander format.
I think they had, at Gen Con, they had one day of Legacy Highlander, but it didn't enter into the calculation for the overall world champ in any way.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just quickly looking at the people that you had to basically beat to become number one in the Joust that year. And I've seen some pretty big names. I've seen Eric Butzloff, you mentioned he's still a very good player from DC. I see Greg Atkinson, my personal hero in, in Thrones.
Okay.
And the other people that maybe haven't been in the limelight recently but are known to be strong players, like Matt Lay, Rings.
Krause from California still plays quite actively as well.
Absolutely. John Krause, another very strong player. So
I mean, I remember him. I the two games I remember distinctly were John Krause and Eric Butzloff.
Tell me about how you beat Eric Butzloff, because, you see, I have a small problem.
Okay.
And I'm going to admit it on air here, and it's going to sound tough. I've never beat Eric in a cut. I've come up against him three times, and he's knocked me out of three final championships, and it makes me cry. I beat him in the Swiss. I have no problem. I steamrolled him once. We had a long game once, and I won. Another time I beat him. But I just can't beat him in the cut. And so tell me about this game. I'm going to live through you here, if that's okay.
Well, Eric's real problem, I think, in that game was hubris in running all six the North agendas, because if he had not needed 27 power to win the game, he probably would have taken it. But the fact that the Lannister Neil deck was entirely about stalling, and his deck was trying to rush me out but couldn't quite get there. I mean, I remember at times he was easily in the 20s in terms of power, but because he just needed so much, and I could slow him down enough to just sort of nickel and dime him on the way to victory. That was actually probably one of my, I don't want to say least proud, but more showmanship moments at the end of that game, was I had 14 power, and I had half the people watching the match standing behind me, including my friends, and half the people watching the match standing behind Eric. So I'm drawing, well, I had three Goldtooth Mines at the time, and so drawing however many cards, getting probably like 17 gold from my Lannister locations and characters, and about four cards in, I draw You've Killed the Wrong Dwarf, sitting at 14 power, and I hear everyone behind me kind of gasp, and then I made sure to play through my whole turn and spent every last gold, and then kneeled my own guy at the end of my marshalling phase.
That's horrible. I love it, though, for some reason. I don't know why.
My friends were behind me going, did he not see it? Did he not see what card he drew? He can win the game right now. But I had to. The plan A was to sort of, you know, be a little bit of a jerk about it. And the other plan was to make sure I used all my events to make sure if he had any cancels, I would burn those out before I had the chance to take the game.
Now, you mentioned running all six, the North agendas, and that was very common at the time. It was basically the strat that I think about a quarter of the top eight were using. That means that you're essentially looking to get 27 power. Was going to time an issue? Was there still a time limit to games, or?
There was. I think it might have been 50 minutes, and I don't remember it ever really taking that long. All my games were long, but that's the nature of the Lannister deck. So, you know, I wasn't ever surprised that we were getting close to time. I don't ever remember getting timed out.
For those of you interested in some of the stats that we're discussing about the 2010 tournaments, I've actually hunted down the deck lists and the compositions of both the Gen Con 2010 and Stalic 2010 tournaments, and I've got those in graph form in a Google spreadsheet linked in the chapter data, and it will also be included in a link in the description. So check those out if you want to see what houses were on top, which ones were most played, and what people were playing for agendas, but don't check them out if you're looking for restricted cards, because they didn't exist yet. And do you know how many players were attending? Because actually that's one of the stats that I wasn't able to gather for 2010.
I want to say 50 or 60, I think. Total. It might have been less than that.
Now, you were playing Lanny No Agenda, and so you mentioned Lannister was popular previously, and you sort of brought the deck back. One of the reasons it was popular previously was because Alchemist Guildhall wasn't a limited response, so you could have that and the Castellan. But at the time you were playing, you couldn't have both, or you couldn't trigger both. So was your deck not weaker than the versions from a year previously, or?
I'm sure it was. Well, Alchemist Guildhall fills a niche that a fair amount of Lannister other kneeling doesn't help. Like specifically the Red Viper, specifically not immune to locations.
And Martell was very popular that year. I can see from the stats it was like over a quarter of the field. So
yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that was actually, I mean, the location kneel was how I ended up beating John Krause. So
you mentioned that that's how you beat John Krause. Can you tell us a little bit about the game, what you can remember of it?
Yeah, I actually remember it was pretty early on in the game, probably round two or three, I'd imagine. And for whatever reason, I mean, you have to like, it's as friendly as the game and the environment is, you have to sometimes take advantage of the tournament scene to get around from people. So he declared an attack when we both had the same amount of characters on the board and couldn't, you know, due to the nature of the tournament, he had declared it. So I reminded him that Red Viper kneels when you have the same amount of characters as your opponents. And he was crestfallen, but he knelt, and that was the turn that I got Lannisport Brothel out. So I just kept Lannisport Brothel off to the side, and he kept the Red Viper off to the side.
Wow, so that basically could have been the game for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it was basically entirely thanks to the Lannisport Brothel.
So you look at, like, small errors like this can really change a whole tournament. And it's actually one of the reasons that when I play in my meta, that I'm trying to train up or play with them, and I want them to do the same thing to me so I don't forget things, I say no.
Yeah.
So it's kind of funny. You know, in friendlier games, I'm actually more strict for some reason. After the cut for me, all gloves are off. You have to look at every single little thing and be really strict on the rules.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly where it was in terms of that. He was like, I'm going to attack with these guys. I was like, okay. Well, he kneels. And he's like, oh, you're right. I'm like, yes, I am.
To the victor go the spoils. So for winning this tournament, you had fame and fortune and glory. Yep. And you also got a chance to design a card, which wound up being a fairly controversial card. Much less so now than before. So I'm looking at the Laughing Storm right now, and I imagine that you're the old grandmother in the back behind the cheering guy's elbow?
Yeah, yeah, that's And the artwork, I can shout out to Tiziano Baracci, who was super nice and did a really, really, really nice job.
Yeah, it's fantastic artwork. I'm sure it looks just like you, he says.
Yeah. but yeah, I have a really nice print of that actually framed in the on the wall at home.
So why design a bear card? Why this card? And tell us a little bit about the process of getting that out.
All right. Well, the first thing that I know, and I said, I believe I said it on the interview the day after that was on their website for a bit, was I just wanted, like, I've always played Bera. Like, before that, like, the Gen Con before that, I was running Bera Summer, and basically up until then I had been running Bera Rush, but really hadn't been able to do anything with it because we were always accusing FFG of not being kind to Bera in terms of draw, and really you need reliable draw to win. I mean, it's just kind of a fact. So I was trying to do something that would help Bera in terms of hand protection at the very least, or draw at the best, because also, I mean, Bera doesn't have they're heavy hitters, don't have a ton of intrigue.
So what made you choose the Laughing Storm?
Yeah, he's not a character that most people think of reading the book. And the flavor quote is absolutely awesome. Oh, you're missing at least two ha's there.
Sorry, I have it in front of me. There's eight. The Laughing Storm is, I'd wanted to do something because most of the big, I didn't want to do a character that already had, you know, like two or three versions. Like, I didn't want to do a Baratheon brother, and I was looking through, like, the Bera Bannerman, and I didn't want to do some random member of the Rainbow Guard or this, that, or the other, which I know people on the forums are upset with. They're like, oh, well, we shouldn't go back in time. We need characters, you know, there's no whoever card. And I'm like, okay, I don't care about that. So basically, he, from reading the Duncan Egg series, without, you know, since I wasn't able to do some of the named characters from those, because I think there were rights issues in terms of actually doing Dunk or Egg or that kind of thing. So I decided to do the Laughing Storm, because he's one of the unsung heroes of that book. because he comes to Dunk's aid in his joust, spoilers,
in the
first one. plus, he's just his showmanship, I thought, was very appealing.
So, appealing. You killed the wrong dwarf at the end of marshalling. That's showmanship. That fits perfectly. I like it a lot. So, for those of you who don't know, the reason this card was controversial was it was a champion card. They're typically designed to catch the eye and be quite powerful, but a lot of fun. But this one hit the restricted list before the card was even released.
Yeah.
Was that something that you would talk to the developers about, or was that did that come out of the blue for you?
No.
Did it just make you mad?
The main thing that I didn't care for in terms of the Laughing Storm was my idea for him was to get him to be, A, to be cost-effective, because there were a lot of 4-3, 4-cost, 3-strength guys in Vera already, and I wanted him to be something really synergistic with good rush decks so that he could be run in a variety of houses, and that's why I wanted to keep him 3-cost, because if he was good and 3-strength and only 5, then you could see him for 5 in other decks, theoretically. Mm-hmm. But through some decision that I was not a part of, and this is after having him whittled down from Noble Crest and War Crest and Lord and Knight and and all these other things. When he came out, he was House Baratheon only, which was kind of disappointing for me, because I wanted him to, you know, to be like a good card that everyone would want to run, because that's what a champion wants, is to see their card in a lot of decks.
To get back to the idea, so you mentioned that you no longer play. Why is that, out of curiosity? It's always a question I like to ask former champions, especially.
I felt, and my meta mates agreed with me, that the game was going in a direction that we didn't really agree with or appreciate in terms of what style of deck was being made powerful and then staying that way. And it was a style preferred by certain big players that we didn't really care for, and it didn't seem like it was going to ever go in the other direction in terms of, you know, what was getting the preferential treatment in the design process.
Was Worlds your last big tournament, or did you gradually fade away?
That was my last time playing in the Joust. I played in the Melee, I think. It must have been the next year. And all I did then was run Greyjoy Choke to play Kingmaker.
Oh, dear. The sign of a bitter man. Sign
a little
of a
bit, yeah. just pick someone and knock them out. But
at the time, the only big event was Gen Con Worlds, but this was actually the first year that Stalic, which had existed for a while, the European Championship, was given sort of official recognition, and they gave the winner of that tournament a card design and so on. So what was the North American perception of the Stalic tournament?
I remember actually there was a fair bit of attention paid to the European guys, just because that they were running things that we didn't necessarily run in the States. Like, they were... It's just different strategies have emerged, I guess, in terms of what was good, what was popular. So it was just interesting to see what they were doing versus what we were doing. Also, I remember they were a little bitter that I was world champion, having beaten a bunch of Americans.
Now, I can see the justification, especially since Stalic in that year had about 80 attendees, and ever since has continued to grow. It's been the biggest tournament every year it's been held.
Yep.
So I can certainly see that as a justification, although now there's actually North American Nationals and there's the World Championships. So the World Championships invite national winners from other countries as well. So there's at least a little more justification in calling it a World Championship, more so,
right,
say, the World Series. The Stalic field was a little different because the Brotherhood cycle had come out, or started coming out, but I think that was one Brotherhood Without Banners deck made the cut. It wasn't a huge splash. There was still a lot of people playing the North. The winning deck was a Martell the North, played by Andrea Lodoni, who got to design Mira Reed. But so was it the fallout from both tournaments or one tournament? Because obviously after this, the next FAQ that was released changed the North agendas to change so that you couldn't field both the Night's Watch and the Wildling ones.
Right.
So did you feel that, or did people at the time feel that was reactionary because of Worlds, or because of Stalic, or because of both, or should they have done something in between to change the field?
I don't know. I mean, it always seemed kind of excessive to be running six agendas and need 27 power, but I mean, that was a personal preference of mine.
And wait, I do remember one thing I wanted to chat about, tournament support. So it's changed a lot within the years, and I was kind of curious as to what kind of prizes were awarded for regional events or for nationals in your case, and what kind of stuff you remember from that.
Well, it was, we fell out of the meta right around the time, I guess, they started doing patches. I have one Stark patch, and I don't remember, I don't know if they ever finished that series, but the big prizes to get when I was in regionals were the smaller plastic power tokens and the flag pins, the pennant pins, and I'm a big fan of tchotchkes and baubles, so I made an effort to do my best to collect all six of those. I actually ended up getting all six of the banner pins and all six of the original pins, the shield crests. So
I've actually seen some people that have those pins across their playmat at the top when they play.
Yeah.
And the newer players always look down and they're like, what's that? I'm like, it means that this person's been playing for a little while and you're probably going to lose. If there was one big impression that you had from that year or Thrones in general at that time, what was it?
I remember it was kind of, I was kind of surprised with myself that I did as well as I did. I'll say that. Up against, because at that point, I mean, there's so much weight behind the big name players like Eric and Greg and that I remember the year before that I went up against Greg and he beat me. Even I don't remember if I had gotten, I don't think I had made it was the cut yet, but he beat me, and it was a close game, but he was still a really nice guy, and it's just good. It was good at the time to see that the good players were still as friendly as they were, you know, just in terms of the environment. So everyone was everyone got along. It seems like, you know, it was like 40 of your good friends just getting together to play cards.
Yeah, I do find the environment still like that today, which is great. You know, lots of people get together to drink beer afterwards, go out and play. They play serious when they're playing, but afterwards it's a good time.
Yep.
I think that's it.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks a lot for doing this.
All right.
Thank you very much again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
In closing, I'd like to remind everyone that we will be resuming our house series next week. We'll be moving on to Greyjoy and discussing how they fit in the meta and some of the top decks with a guest, of course. And, you know, I apologize for this break, but I think it's nice that we're able to start our sort of AGOT retrospective series that we've been talking about for a while. So we have already interviewed several champs for similar segments, hopefully to use when things go awry like this and we can't get the recording in on at the moment that we'd want to, because most of these segments are fairly immortal. They're things you could go back to a year later and still use the same recording. So hopefully you enjoyed that. Let us know what you think of that kind of segment and how you'd like the other ones to be phrased as we go throughout the years, which champions you'd most like to hear from. Other than that, this is actually almost, I'd say it's a lull in the regional season. I think this weekend or this coming weekend, that is the 31st and the 1st, will only be host to the Barcelona in Spain regional. And even that I'm not sure about, because I saw data reported for a tournament in Barcelona. So I think they have their regional this coming weekend. Aside from that, I don't know of any regionals. However, there is a major tournament going on in the UK. UK Nationals are going on this weekend. The format's a little different. This is the first year that they've gotten a Nationals. I'm really interested to see what comes out of that. It'll be the culmination of a very interesting season, regional season to date. And I hope that it'll set a nice precedent so that in subsequent years they can get the Nationals that they're hoping for, rather than having to take the format that they were given at a fairly last minute. So I hope you guys didn't mind the break in format, or will at least allow us to wow you again next week, returning to our regular format. And I think you'll all realize why it is that John and I do this together, rather than being forced to listen to me monologue like this.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.